weeks away. We slept in the woods, warmed by fires. Folk would see those fires and wonder who had set them, but we were still far south of the Ribble, and I doubted that Arnborg would hear of us. Men must have seen us, even if we did not see them, but all they saw were some 90 armed riders with their servants and spare horses. We flew no banner, and the wolf heads on our shields were faded. If any folk did see us, they would avoid us because in a dangerous land we were the danger. Next day, late in a cold afternoon, we saw the Ribble. It was a sullen day with a grey sky and a grey sea, and ahead of us stretched the wide estuary where grey mudbanks were edged with endless marshes. Smoke rose into the windless air from a dozen settlements on the estuary's shores. No ships disturbed the river's channels that threaded the mud, though I could see a score of fishing boats hauled above the high tide mark. It was close to low tide now, and some of the withies marking the channels were out of the water, which swirled fast and flat. The tide was big there, and the river was draining to the sea. "Good living," Finan murmured, and he was right. I could see the fish traps in the tangled channels, and both the mudbanks and the water were bright with birds, seabirds and shorebirds, swans and waders, godwits and plovers, geese and sanderlings. "Dear God," Finan said, "but look at those fowl. You'd never go hungry here." "There's good salmon, too," I said. Dudda, a shipmaster who had once guided us across the Irish Sea, had told me the Ribble was a marvellous river for salmon. Dudda was a drunkard, but a drunkard who knew this coast, and he had often told me his dream of settling beside the Ribble's estuary, and I could see why. The settlers were Norsemen now. I doubted they had seen us. We had approached the river slowly, leading our horses, only moving when our scouts gave a signal. Most of my men and all our horses were now in a swale of icy puddles and brittle reeds, hidden from the riverlands by a low rise crowned with trees and brush where I had posted a dozen men. I joined them, climbing the shallow slope quietly and slowly, not wanting to explode birds from their nests. And once on the crest I could see far across the estuary, and see rich steadings, too many steadings. As soon as we rode out of the icy swale we would be seen, and the news of armed strangers would spread across the riverlands, and Arnborg, wherever he was, would be warned of our coming. I was gazing at the closest steading, a substantial hall and barn surrounded by a freshly repaired palisade. The thatch on one of the lower buildings was new, while smoke rose from a hole in the highest roof. A boy and a dog were driving sheep towards the steading's open gates, where one man slouched. The man was far away, but Finan, who had the keenest eyesight of any man I knew, reckoned he wore no mail and carried no weapon. "We go there tonight," I told Finan. "You, me, Berg, and Kettle." I had no need to explain what I planned. Finan nodded.
"And the second group?"
"Edric can pick a dozen men." Finan looked up at the clouded sky.
"There'll be no moon," he warned,
meaning that we would be shrouded in utter darkness, liable to lose our way and blunder helplessly in the night.
"Then we go slowly and carefully," I said.
I watched the last sheep disappear into the steading and saw the gates closed. The raw wood where the palisade had been patched suggested that whoever owned the steading had gone to expense and trouble to keep his home safe, yet the man guarding the gate had looked anything but alert. My father had always said that ramparts don't make you safe. It's the men guarding the ramparts who keep your women from rape, your children from slavery, and your livestock from slaughter. I guess that whoever was in the steading wished nothing more than to stay warm. It was a freezing winter afternoon. The sheep were safely home, and sensible folk would want to stay close to their hearth, confident that the wolves were locked out. We waited deep into that dark night. It was cold, and we dared not set any fires. We shivered. The only lights were glimmers of firelight showing in a handful of the homesteads. The closest one showed no light except, at first, a faint fire glow in the hole of the hall's roof, and even that faded. And still we waited, too cold to sleep.
"We'll be warm soon," I murmured to the men close to me.
I had memorized the look of the land. I knew we must walk across rough pasture to find a ditch, and then follow the ditch north and west until we came to a straggling hedge that would take us east to the track where we had seen the sheep being herded, and that track would lead us to the closest steading. And we must become Shaldugenjin, the shadow walkers, creatures of the night. It is no wonder that the gates are closed and the hall doors barred at night, because the darkness is when the Shaldugenjin walk. They are shapeshifters, goblins, elves, sprites, and dwarves. They might choose to appear as beasts, as wolves or bulls. They come from Midgard to haunt the land, and they are neither alive nor dead. They are horrors from the shadows. And as at last we cross the pasture, treading carefully in the absolute darkness, I thought of the old poem, The Lay of Beowulf, which had been chanted in my father's hall and was still chanted in the same hall, now mine. Come on, Warnit, Shriven Shaldugenjin, Shaten Shwalden, the harpist declaimed, and we would shudder at the thought of ghouls slithering from the darkness. Then out of the night slides the shadow walker, stealthy warrior. And we were the stealthy warriors. I chanted the phrase over and over in my head as we left the woodland and walked towards the ditch. Shriven Shaldugenja, Shaten Shwalden. Shriven Shaldugenja, Shaten Shwalden. Over and over I said it silently, a mindless chant to keep the demons away. The approach to the steading seemed to take much longer than I had anticipated, so that I began to fear we had lost our way. But at last I smelled wood smoke, and Finnan must have seen some faint glow off to our left because he plucked my cloak. "This way," he whispered. We followed the track. No grass beneath our feet now, only frost-hardened mud, sheep droppings and horse dung, but there was the smallest glimmer of flame-light showing through a shutter of the hall that revealed a chink between the palisade's logs. No dog barked, no one shouted a challenge, as at last we reached the steading. The gate was edged by two high trunks into which iron hinges were secured. We heard nothing except our footfalls, the sigh of a small night wind, the distant howl of a vixen, and an owl calling. "Ready," I murmured to Berg and Kettle.
"Ready,"
Berg answered. I stood with my back to the gate, linked my hands to make a step, and Berg, who was young and strong, put his hands on my shoulder, one foot on my hands, and heaved himself upwards. I pushed him as he went. He made a scrabbling noise as he straddled the gate's top, and I waited for the howl of dogs as Kettle took his place.
"I'm over,"
Berg called softly. He had jumped down on the gate's far side, and I heaved Kettle up. He followed Berg over the gate, and I thought the noise they made must wake the dead, especially when the two lifted the great locking bar that scraped in its brackets. Still no barking. The hinges squealed as Berg and Kettle pushed the gate open.
"Call Edric," I said,
and Finnan gave a short, sharp whistle. Edric's men had followed us, and now they spread around the whole steading, their task to make certain no one left by a gate we had not seen or by climbing as Berg and Kettle had done. Edric himself, with two men, joined us as Berg and Kettle pushed the great gate fully open.
"Easy work, Lord,"
Kettle said.
So far.
The dogs woke at that moment. There were two of them that began barking somewhere to my left, but they had to be tethered because neither came close. The sheep began bleating, which only made the dogs even noisier. Finnan and I had gone to the hall door, and I heard movement on the far side. Then a woman's voice shouted at the dogs to stop their noise. I drew serpent breath as Finnan slid Soul Stealer from her long scabbard. I'd expected to break the hall door down, but it seemed the folk inside would open it for us, because I heard the bar being lifted and a wooden bolt shot. The door was pushed open, immediately throwing light into the yard. Inside the hall, a servant was feeding the hearth, and flames leapt up, and in that brighter light I saw two men, both bareheaded and neither wearing mail, standing with long spears a couple of paces beyond the door. A woman swathed in a blanket stood between them. And what did they see? They saw a nightmare. They saw warriors with drawn swords, warriors in mail, warriors with decorated helmets and closed cheekpieces, cloaked warriors, night warriors, shadow walkers with naked blades. One of the two men raised his spear and I smacked it aside with serpent breath. The man's move had been tentative. He was too scared to attack with any force. Maybe he had hardly meant to threaten me, but had just raised his blade without thinking. He gasped as my heavier blade drove the spear out of his hand. It clattered to the floor as Finnan and I stalked into the hall. Edric and his men followed us closely. "Drop that spear," I snarled at the second man, and when he did not obey, Finnan just took the weapon from him.
"Who are you?" the woman asked.
She showed more defiance than the two men who backed away from us. Her grey hair was tied in a knot at the nape of her neck, beneath a white woolen cap. She was tall, stoutly built, with a commanding face and indignant eyes. She clutched the heavy blanket around her shoulders and stared at me belligerently.
"Who are you?"
she demanded again.
"Your guests," I said, and walked past her to the hearth, where the servant who had been reviving the fire now cowered.
"Edric?"
"Lord!"
Edric ran to me, grateful for what small warmth the hearth gave.
"Saxons!"
the woman spat at me. I ignored her.
"Search the steading," I told Edric, "then light a fire in the yard and try not to burn down the palisade."
The fire's glow would be a signal to our men still waiting in the swale, where the puddles were thick ice. Edric, an older man and utterly reliable, was probably the best of my scouts. He twisted some dry floor rushes around a piece of wood, stooped to light it, and then carried the makeshift torch into the darkness, followed by two of his men.
"Kettle, Berg, search the hall,"
I ordered. There was a high platform in the hall, and beneath it a separate chamber.
"Look in there,"
I told Berg, pointing to the chamber's door, then sheathed serpent breath and walked back to the woman.
"Your name?" I asked in Danish, a language most of the Norse understood.
"My name is not for Saxon scum," she said.
I looked at the two disarmed men. "Your servants?" She did not answer, but did not need to. She was plainly in command of this household, and the two men looked as frightened of her as they were of me.
"I'll blind both," I said, "one eyeball at a time till you tell me your name."
She wanted to defy me, but relented when I drew a knife from my belt and one of the servants whimpered.
"Fritha,"
she said reluctantly.
"Widow? Wife? What?"
"I am married to Halbjorn," she said proudly, "and he will come soon, come with all his men."
"I'm terrified," I answered.
Edric's men were carrying firewood from the hall into the yard. There was some small danger of alerting the nearest steadings if we lit a great fire in the open air, but it was a risk I was willing to take. Even if someone saw the flames, I doubted they would investigate on this dark, freezing night, and I needed to bring my men and horses out of the cold and into warmth and shelter. Berg, grinning happily, pushed two maidservants into the hall.
"No one else here, Lord," he said. and there's just one door at the back.
Barred?
Yes, Lord.
Keep it barred, I said, then pointed at the maids. You two, find food and ale. Bring it, all of it.
One of the girls glanced at Fritha as if seeking her permission, and I just growled. Took one pace towards her, and she ran. Fritha had noticed the hammer amulet that hung over my mail. She saw the same symbol around Berg's neck, then glanced at Finnan, who wore a cross. She was confused, and I saw that she was about to speak when there was a sudden shout from outside the hall, a yelp, then a moment of silence before men laughed. Fritha clutched her hands together. Edric came in from the yard, where the fire was now burning.
"More women and children in the small hall, Lord," he said. "Two slaves in the barn, pair of dogs, a flock of mangy sheep, and just one horse."
"Bring all the people in here," I ordered him. "And what was that noise we just heard?"
Edric shrugged.
"It was outside, Lord."
The answer to my question proved to be a boy, no more than 11 or 12, who was dragged in by a grinning Folkbold, the big Frisian.
"The little bugger jumped the palisade, Lord," Folkbold explained, "and was running away."
"Don't hurt him," Fritha called. "Lord, please."
I walked to her, stared her in the eye. "So I'm no longer scum?"
"Please, Lord," she said.
"Your son?" I guessed, and she nodded. "Your only son?" She nodded again. "His name?" I demanded.
"Hjogrimir,"
she said the name in a whisper. There were tears in her eyes.
"Where were you going, Hjogrimir?"
I asked the boy, though I still looked into his mother's eyes.
"To get help,"
the boy answered, and I could hear the defiance in his unbroken voice. I turned to see him glaring at me. Folkbold loomed above him, grinning. I looked back to his mother, but still talked to the boy.
"And tell me, Hjogrimir, where your father is?"
"Coming to kill you."
"Many have tried, boy. I filled the benches of Valhalla with men who thought I could be killed. Now tell me what I want to know."
The boy was stubbornly silent, and it was his mother who answered.
"He has gone to join his lord."
"Arnborg?" I guessed.
"Arnborg," she said.
"Arnborg is a great lord,"
the boy called behind me.
"Arnborg," I said, "is a piece of toad shit. And where is he?"
I still gazed into Fritha's eyes and saw a flicker of fear there.
"I won't tell you,"
Hjogrimir called boldly.
"Folkbold," I said, still looking at Fritha, "how do we kill small boys these days?"
Folkbold must have looked bemused because he said nothing, but Kettle, who was searching the hall's high platform, was quick-witted.
"We killed the last one by nailing his head to a wall, Lord."
"I remember," I said, and smiled at Fritha. "Where is Arnborg?"
"They went east, Lord,"
she said.
"The nail went in quickly, am I right, Kettle?"
"Much too fast, Lord," he called down to me. "He died before he could tell us anything. You said the next time we must drive the nail slowly.
And how did we kill the boy before that?"
"Oh, that one screamed, Lord,"
Kettle said happily.
"Wasn't he the one we burned to death?"
"No,"
Folkbald had at last understood what we were saying.
"We skinned that little bastard alive. It was the youngster before him we burnt, remember? He was a fat little boy, and he sizzled. Smelled like bacon on the hot rock."
"Arnborg went east,"
Fritha said desperately.
"I don't know where."
I believed her. "When?" I asked.
"A fortnight ago."
I heard hoofbeats sounding in the firelit yard, and knew the rest of my men had brought the horses safely to the steading, which was now ours. The hall began to get crowded as my warriors came into the warmth, and as the men, women, and children we had captured were driven inside.
"How many men rode with your husband?" I asked Fritha.
6, Lord.
"And how many with Arnborg?"
She shrugged.
many, lord?
She plainly did not know, but I pressed her anyway.
Many? 100? 200?
Many, lord!
To join Skål? I asked.
She nodded.
Yes, lord, to join Skål. Skål is a great king,
her son called defiantly.
He is a warrior of the wolf. He has a sorcerer who turns men into ice.
I ignored him, dismissing his words as a child's boast. And Skål, I still talked to Fritha. Where did he go?
East, lord,
she said helplessly. And Arnborg's hall, I asked. How far is it?
Close, lord.
And how many men has he left there? She hesitated, then saw me glance at her son.
Maybe 20, lord.
We shut the gates, put the horses in the smaller hall and the barns, fed the great hearth, ate Halbjorn's food, and some of us slept, though only after we had questioned every captive and learned that Arnborg's hall truly was close, built beside the Ribble where the river widened out to the great estuary. Fritha, scared for her son's life, was eager to talk now and reckoned it was less than an hour's walk.
"You can see it from our roof, lord," she said.
"He'll have left men there," Finnan said to me in the dawn. "But where is he gone? Where has Skål gone?" "East," Finnan said unhelpfully. "Maybe just a cattle raid? A big one? In winter? There'll be few cattle outside." We slaughtered our herds as the autumn faded and winter's grip chilled the land, keeping alive just enough beasts to breed for the following year, and most of those precious animals would be behind palisades. I had the dread feeling that I had made the wrong decision, that I should not be seeking the treacherous monk, but hurrying back to Bebbanburg. But Fritha had said her menfolk had left 2 weeks before, which meant that whatever they had left to do had probably been done already. And we had come this far, so we might as well find the monk with the scarred tonsure, if indeed he had returned here. Which meant we must capture Arnborg's hall. Nothing in war is simple, though fate had been kind to us on the night we took Halbjorn's steading. We lost one horse that broke a leg when he stumbled into a ditch, but otherwise the worst we suffered was cold. Assaulting Arnborg's hall would not be so easy. But at least the capture of Halbjorn's steading had taken us close to the hall, and better still, we had been undiscovered. We were on Arnborg's land, and none of his men knew we were there. Yet the moment we left the steading, we could no longer hide. We must race across the winter ground to reach the palisade before any news of our coming alerted the men left to guard the hall. We had questioned Fritha and her people, and had learned that the hall was built beside a creek of the Ribble, that it was surrounded by barns and huts, that it had a strong palisade, and that Arnborg had left a garrison to protect his home. One servant, who had carried eggs to the hall the day before, agreed with Fritha that there were perhaps 20 men.
Or maybe 30, lord?
Maybe 40, perhaps 50, Finnan growled as we spurred the horses on frost-hardened ground. At least he's not in the Roman fort, I said. I had feared Arnborg might have occupied the old fort that lay well inland, but it seemed from what we had heard that Arnborg liked to be close to the Ribble's estuary so that his ships could slip out to sea where rich cargoes could be captured. 20 men did not sound like a fearsome enemy, but their advantage was that they could shelter behind their palisade, and though that wooden fence might not be as formidable as Bebbanburg's great ramparts, it would still be a daunting obstacle, which is why we rode hard and fast. If the defenders knew we were coming, they could prepare, but if we appeared suddenly and unexpectedly, then half of them would be in the hall, warming themselves by the hearth. We followed a well-beaten track that curved around the Ribble's numerous channels. We crossed salt marshes, threaded reed beds, and all around us the shore birds called and flew away in great flocks. No one could miss the sight of those thousands of white wings filling the sky, so Arnborg's men would know someone was moving on the estuary's bank. But why would they suspect an enemy? Our horses' hooves smashed the cat ice where the track forded a shallow creek. Serpent breath was bouncing at my hip, while the shield on my back thumped rhythmically against my spine. We climbed a long, shallow slope topped by a thick windbreak of willow and alder, ducked under low branches, and cantered out into the thin sunlight again, and there was Arnborg's steading, just as Frithers' people had described it. It was a shrewd place to make a haul. One of the many creeks of the Ribble curved here, and the water protected two sides of the high palisade. Three ships were moored in that creek, tied to a timber wharf that lay on the northern side of Arnborg's steading, which stretched southwards by at least 60 paces. Inside the wall were the roofs of a hall and a cluster of other buildings, barns, stables, and storehouses. The one gate I could see was on the southern side, and it was closed. A flag hung above the gate, but in that morning's windless air it was impossible to see any badge or symbol on the cloth. There had to be a fighting platform beside the gate, because two spearmen stood there, both just gaping at us for the moment. I waved to them, hoping the gesture would convince them we were friends, but I saw one turn and shout back into the steading. There were two ways to capture a walled steading. The first and easiest was to show the defenders by how many they were outnumbered, and promise that they would live if they surrendered. It usually worked, but I knew I would probably have to fight for this haul. Arnborg was a warrior and a leader of warriors, and we knew he had left a garrison to defend his home, and that suggested they would rather fight than betray their lord's trust. So fight we would. But if we were to fight, I wanted it to be quick. "Berg," I called, "you know what to do, so do it." I swerved off the track, going away from the palisade and forcing Tintrig onto a ploughed field that slowed him. Finnan and most of my men followed, but Berg led 11 of my youngest and most agile warriors straight towards the palisade's closest corner, which was protected, like the rest of the landward wall, by a flooded ditch. Reeds grew in the ditch and betrayed that it was not deep. Indeed, I suspected that the ditch dried out quickly on a falling tide. One of the slaves at Halbjorn's farm had said the ditch was little more than knee-deep, and I could only hope he was right. The man who had shouted from the fighting platform was calling again, pointing to the corner where I saw Berg's horse scramble into the ditch, and saw Berg steady himself with one hand on the palisade as he stood on the saddle. Then I watched as he reached up and grasped the wall's top. For a heartbeat he was poised against the winter sky. Then he scrambled over, and I saw there must be a platform at the corner because Berg was able to stand there, lean over and help the next man. The other horses crowded into the ditch, and it seemed to take a long time, but at last all 12 managed to climb from their horses' backs, clamber over the high wall, and jump from the fighting platform to the ground beyond. "Remember when we could have done that?" Finnan asked. He had reined in beside me. I laughed. "If we had to, my friend, we still could." "Two shillings says you'd have fallen off the horse," he said, and he was probably right. The fighting platform did not extend along the whole length of the southern wall, because the two spearmen at the gate had disappeared from sight, rather than run to confront the invaders. I heard a shout, the clang of swords, and I nudged Tintrig towards the gate. The noise from within the steading was louder, the harsh clash and scrape of blade on blade, a bellow of anger. "I should have led them," I said. "You'd still be halfway up the wall," Finnan said. "That's a job for young fools, not old men like us." And my young fools, proud warriors, did what we had demanded. I saw Godric appear on the gate's fighting platform, waving us forward, and then the gate was pushed open and I spurred Tintrig as I drew serpent breath. We had surprised the garrison, and now we would punish them for being surprised. I kicked Tintrig out of the ploughland back onto the track, His hooves thundered on the hard-packed earth of the brief causeway that crossed the shallow ditch. I ducked under the crossbar that crowned the gate, and saw a group of men running to my left, intent on attacking Berg's young warriors, who had their backs to the palisade and were fighting off an equal number of sword Norse. But most of the Norsemen were not in mail and wore no helmets. Then someone screamed a challenge to my right, and I slewed Tintrig to face the sound and saw a spear coming towards me. I wrenched Tintrig back to the left, the spear slashed close beside me, so close that the leaf blade sliced my right boot. I spurred towards the warrior who had thrown it. Then she screamed again, and I saw it was a woman. She was dressed in a thick wool gown covered by a heavy cloak of dark fur, and had a silver-chased helmet crammed over black hair. She was shouting for someone to bring her another spear, but it was too late. My horsemen were crowding through the gate. They lowered their spears and rode at Berg's assailants. I saw a blade slice into a spine, saw the man arch back like a bow under tension. Then the Norsemen were dropping their swords and kneeling in surrender. At least two bodies lay in blood, while a wounded man crawled towards the huts with his guts trailing in the mud. A dog howled. The woman still screamed for another spear, so I rode to her and slapped serpent breath across her helmet, and she seized my leg and tried to haul me from the saddle. I hit her again much harder, still using the flat of the blade, and this time she staggered back, her helmet askew and a tangle of black hair shrouding her angry face. "Shut the gates!" I called to Berg. "Did you lose anyone?" Finan called.
"None."
Berg was hauling the gates closed.
"You did well," I shouted.
And it had been well done. The young men had crossed a palisade, and they had fought off defenders who, though they had been surprised, had been more numerous and had reacted faster than we had expected. I tucked the hammer at my breast and silently thanked the gods for our success, and it was at that moment that I was struck. I was struck by a thought, that when the gods favour you one moment, they will punish you the next. And in that moment of small victory, beneath a clearing sky, the darkness came. The sudden thought was as sharp as Gungnir, Odin's dreadful spear, and it told me that I was cursed. I cannot tell how I knew I was cursed, but know it I did. I knew that the gods were laughing at me while the three Norns, those heartless spinners at the foot of Yggdrasil, were amusing themselves with my life threads. The sun was shining, but I felt as though storm-dark clouds were shrouding the world, and I just sat in the saddle, not moving, gazing blindly towards the huts where a crowd of Arnborg's people were watching us nervously.
"Lord?"
Finan edged his horse close to mine.
"Lord!"
he said again, louder. I looked up for a sign, for any omen that I was not cursed. A bird in flight would reveal the will of the gods, I thought, but no birds showed. In that place of birds, beside an estuary of birds, there was just the burning winter sun, the pale sky, and the high rippled clouds.
"There's a curse on me," I said.
"No, Lord," Finan said, touching the cross at his breast.
"It's a curse," I said.
"We should have gone to Bebbanburg, not here."
"No, Lord," Finan said again.
"Just find the monk," I said.
"If he's here, find him."
Though what good would it do to find Brother Beedwulf if I were cursed? I could fight Arnborg, I could fight Skoll, I could fight Athelhelm, but I could not fight the gods. I was cursed. Weird bith full arad.
Chapter 4. The gods are not kind to us, any more than children are kind to their toys. We are here to amuse the gods, and at times it amuses them to be unkind. The Christians, of course, claim that any misfortune is caused by our own sin,
that ill fate is there nailed God's way of punishing us. And if you point out that the wicked thrive, they simply say that their God is unknowable, meaning they have no explanation. I had done nothing I could think of to earn the displeasure of the gods, but I did not need to have offended them. They were simply amusing themselves, playing with me like a child plays with a toy. And so I clutched the hammer amulet in my gloved hand and prayed I was wrong. Perhaps my conviction that I was cursed was false, but there were no birds in the winter sky, and that omen told me I was the plaything of cruel gods. Cruel? Yes, of course, just as children are cruel. I remember Father Bjorka crowing with delight when I had once said that our gods are like children.
"How can a god be like a child?" he had demanded.
"Don't you Christians say we must be like Christ?" He had frowned, suspecting a trap, then had nodded reluctantly.
"We must indeed be Christ-like, yes."
"And when I was a child," I had pressed him, "didn't you tell me that your nailed god said we must all be like little children?" He had just stared at me, spluttered for a moment, then had remarked that the weather was getting colder. I miss Father Bjorka. He would have dismissed my fears of being cursed, but I could not dismiss the certainty that my fate was suddenly dire. All I could do now was survive, and the beginning of that survival was to discover whether the monk Beedwulf was still in Arnborg's fort.
"Erika,"
Finan said behind me. I turned, puzzled, to see him gripping the arm of the angry woman who had tried to kill me with her thrown spear.
"She's called Erika," Finan explained, "and she's Arnborg's wife."
"Where is Arnborg?" I asked her.
"Hunting you," she said.
"Hunting me where?"
"Wherever he is."
"I can make her talk, Lord," Edric said.
He spoke in English so that Erika did not understand him, but she understood the vicious look on his face. "No," I said, then swung down from Tintrig's saddle and called for Rorik to take the stallion. "Lady," I spoke to Erika, "last night we took Halbjorn's farm. His wife defied me too. Where do you think she is now?" Erika did not answer. She was a fine-looking woman, maybe 30 years old, with dark eyes and a high-boned face. "Halbjorn's wife," I told her, "lives, as does her son. We hurt neither of them, and I left her silver to pay for the food we ate. Do you understand me?" She still just stared at me silently. "I've no wish to hurt you," I went on, "but I do need answers, and I promise I will get them one way or the other. It would be easier, I think, if you just talked to me. So, where is Arnborg?"
"Gone east," she said curtly.
"Where?"
"East,"
she said stubbornly.
"With Skoll?"
"With Jarl Skoll, yes. And pray you never meet him or his sorcerer." She spat towards me, but her spittle fell short. The mention of Skoll's famous sorcerer made me shudder. Had he cursed me? I walked towards her, serpent breath still naked in my hand. I saw her eye the blade nervously. "The missionary monk, Beedwulf, is he here?" She sneered at that question.
"Is that why you came?"
"Is the monk here?" I repeated patiently.
"You can have him,"
she said in derision, then jerked her head towards the buildings beyond the great hall.
"In his hut, of course."
"Which hut?"
"The dirtiest hut, the smallest one."
"We'll be gone soon enough," I said as I sheathed serpent breath, sliding her into her scabbard very slowly so that Erika would take note, and, sure enough, she looked at the blade as I pushed it home. "And my sword," I went on, "is unblooded. But if any of your men lifts a hand against us,
her blade will be drenched in their blood. And if you lift your hand against us, the blood will be yours. I nodded to Finan. Let her go. And so Finan, Berg, and I walked past the great hall, past two barns, and past a reeking blacksmith's forge, to where smaller huts were the homes of Arnborg's warriors. Most of those warriors had ridden with their lord, gone eastwards, but their women were still here, and they watched as we walked towards the last hut, a small thatched hovel with smoke trickling from its roof hole. Newly woven willow fish traps were piled by the doorway. A sullen woman confirmed that it was the monk's home.
"They had a bigger one," she said, "but when the other monk died..."
She shrugged. "And the monk is here?" I asked her.
"He's there," she said.
The hut was nothing but reed thatch, wattle, and sun-baked clay. The entrance was so low that we would have had to crawl inside, so instead I drew serpent breath again and rammed her blade into the moss-covered thatch. A woman screamed from inside, then screamed again as I tore the reeds apart, opening up a gaping hole in the roof, then hacked again to widen the hole down to the low doorway. Finan and Berg helped, pulling away timber, withies, and thatch, and then at last we could look down into the hut's interior. Where there were two people, sitting on the far side of a hearth, where a small fire burned. One, a girl, was clutching a robe to her breasts and staring up at us with wide, frightened eyes, while next to her, looking equally terrified, and with an arm around the girl's thin shoulders, was a man I did not at first recognize. Indeed, I feared I had broken into the wrong hut, because the man sheltering the girl had no tonsure. Instead, he had a full head of dark hair. Then he looked up at me, and I did recognize him.
"Brother Beedwulf," I said.
"No!" he shook his head wildly.
"No!"
"Or is it Brother Osric?" I asked.
"No!"
he whimpered.
"No!"
"Yes," I said. Then stepped into the ruined hut, bent down and seized Brother Beedwulf by his black robe. He yelped, the girl gasped, then I dragged him out, pulling his unresisting body across the burning hearth so that he screamed in pain and his woolen robe started to smoulder. I threw him down among the wreckage of the thatch and watched him beat out the small flames. "Brother Beedwulf," I said, "we need to talk." And so we did. It was the girl, of course. Her name was Winfled. She might have been 13 or 14. She was a Saxon slave, and as skinny as a peeled willow wand. She had large and timid eyes, a pointed nose, reddish hair, and prominent upper teeth. She looked like a half-starved squirrel, and Brother Beedwulf was in love with her. He had taken an oath of celibacy, which is one of the more stupid things that Christians demand of their monks, but squirrel-faced Winfled had proven far stronger than Beedwulf's solemn promises to his nailed god.
"I married her, Lord,"
he confessed as he crouched at my feet. "So you're no longer a monk?"
"I'm not, Lord."
"But you're dressed as a monk," I said, nodding at his scorched habit with its grubby black cowl and rope belt. He shivered, whether out of fear or cold I could not tell. Probably both.
"I have no other clothes, Lord."
The squirrel crept out of the hut's ruins to kneel beside her lover. She lowered her head, then put out a small, pale hand, and Beedwulf took it. Both of them were shaking in fear. "Look at me, girl," I ordered her. And the timid eyes, pale blue, gazed at me fearfully. "You're Saxon?" I asked.
"Mercian, Lord."
Her voice was scarce above a whisper. "A slave?"
"Yes, Lord."
She had been scaring birds away from a newly sown field when the Norse raiders had found her. She said it had happened a year before. I asked her where she came from, and she seemed confused by the question.
"Home, Lord,"
was all she could say. She started crying, and Beedwulf put an arm around her shoulders. "Give me one good reason," I said to him, "why I should not take your head from your shoulders."
"They were going to kill her, lord,"
Beedwulf said. "When fled?"
"Arnborg said he would kill her if I didn't do what he wanted."
He lowered his head and waited. I said nothing.
"They said they would drown her, lord,"
Beedwulf muttered,
"just as they drowned Brother Edwin."
"He was the other missionary?"
"Yes, lord."
"You say they drowned him?"
"You can see him, lord,"
Beedwulf said with a sudden pleading energy. He pointed northwards.
"He's still there, lord."
"Where?"
"Out there, lord."
He had pointed towards a smaller gate that led, I assumed, to the long wharf where the ships were moored. I was curious. "Show me," I said. Berg pushed the gate open, and we went onto the timber wharf. The tide was low, and the three ships were canted on the mud, their mooring lines slack.
"There, lord,"
Beedwulf said, and pointed across the nearest ship's deck. And I saw a thick stake had been driven into the mud bank on the creek's further side. A skeleton hung there, held in place by twisted ropes. The skull had fallen off, the ribs were mangled, and the flesh had long been torn away by beaks. "What happened?" I asked.
"Jarl Arnborg tied him there at low tide, lord."
"Why?"
"The Jarl said we had no need to pay tribute to Mercia, lord, and he had no need of drivelling missionaries, that's what he said, lord."
That made some sense. The Mercian rebellion would have persuaded Arnborg that the Saxons were weakened, and he must have reckoned he no longer needed to pay tribute, nor keep Christian missionaries, and so Brother Edwin had been lashed to the stake, and I imagine the strong tide swirling up the creek, flooding the mud bank, and rising slowly for the amusement of the watching Norse. The monk would have cried out, praying to either his god or the Norse to spare him, to save him. And still that great tide rose, and he would have strained upwards, gasping for every last breath, and in his ears would have been the laughter of his enemies. "Why didn't Jarl Arnborg kill you, too?" I asked Beedwulf. He gave me no answer, so I seized his robe and pushed him to the wharf's edge, where I made him gaze down into the rippled water that just covered the creek's muddy bed. "Why," I snarled, "did Jarl Arnborg not kill you, too?" He made a sound, half whimper, half moan, and I nudged him as though I was about to let him fall. "Tell me," I said.
"He thought I could be useful, lord,"
he whispered. "By telling me lies?"
"Yes, lord,"
he said.
"I'm sorry, lord. Please, lord."
I held him above the shallow water for a few heartbeats, then pulled him back. "Why?" I asked. He was shaking so much that he seemed incapable of answering, and so I threw him hard against the palisade that edged the landward side of the wharf. He slid down to the planks. Winfled started towards him, then stopped when I drew serpent breath.
"No!"
she cried aloud. I ignored her. Instead, I pushed the sword's tip against Beedwulf's throat. "Why," I asked, "did Arnborg want me at Chester?"
"So you would not be at Jorvik, lord."
He had spoken so softly that I thought I had misheard. "So I would not be where?" I demanded.
"At Jorvik, lord. Jorvik."
Jorvik. That was the name that the Danes and Norse used for Jorvik. I stared at Beedwulf, puzzled. "Why would I be at Jorvik?" I asked, more to myself than to the miserable excuse of a man who grovelled at my feet.
"You were there at Christmas, lord,"
he answered,
"and it's known that you're..."
His voice dribbled away to silence. "What is known?" I asked, lifting the sword blade to touch the stubble on his chin.
"That you are of the net, Jorvik, lord."
"Where my son-in-law rules, and where my daughter lives," I said. "So of course I visit Jorvik." And suddenly I understood. Maybe the cold had dulled my wits,
because I had been gaping at Beedwulf like an idiot, his answers making no sense, but now it all made sense. Too much sense. "Are you telling me," I asked him, "that Skoll has gone to Jorvik?"
"Yes, Lord."
His voice was so faint I could scarcely hear him. "Sweet Jesus," Finan said.
"Lord, please,"
Winfled was crying. "Quiet, girl," I snapped. I pulled the sword back. "How many men does he lead?"
"Jarl Arnborg took 63, Lord."
"Not Arnborg, you fool, Skoll."
"I don't know, Lord,"
Beedwulf said. I rammed the sword forward, checking it as the tip pressed on his throat. "How many men did Skoll lead to Jorvik?" I asked. Beedwulf had pissed himself, and a yellow stain showed on the frost-covered planks of the wharf. "How many?" I asked again, keeping the blade at his gullet.
"They all went, Lord,"
Beedwulf said, gesturing across the cold estuary. "All?"
"The Norse, the Danes, all of them, Lord."
He gestured northwards again.
"All, Lord, from here to the Hedin."
The land north of the Ribble was called Cumberland, a wild land. It was supposedly a part of Northumbria, but Æthelstan had been right when he claimed that Cumberland was lawless. Sigtryggr claimed it, but he did not control it. Cumberland was a savage region of mountains and lakes, where the strongest ruled and the weakest were enslaved. The River Hedin was the frontier with Scottish land, and between that border and the Ribble were scores of Danish and Norse settlements. "How many rode to Jofawick?" I asked.
"Hundreds, Lord."
"How many hundreds?"
"Three? Four?"
It was plain Beedwulf did not know.
"They all rode, Lord, all of them. They believed no one would be ready for an assault in the winter."
And that was true, I thought. The fighting season began in the spring, because the winter was when folk crouched by the fire and endured the cold. "So why," I asked, "has Skoll gone to Jofawick?" I knew the answer, but wanted Beedwulf to confirm it. Beedwulf crossed himself, plainly terrified.
"He would be king of Northumbria, Lord."
He dared look up at me, desperation on his face.
"And he is terrible, Lord."
"Terrible?"
"Lord, he has a powerful sorcerer, and Skoll is an Ulfhirdin."
Until that moment, the curse had been a vague fear, as formless as the serpent breath whirls on my sword's blade, but now the fear congealed into something as hard, cold, and terrifying as the blade itself. Because my enemy was a wolf warrior, and he would be king of all Northumbria. I was cursed. Eirika, Arnborg's wife, was laughing at us.
"Skoll's men are the Ulfhirdnar," she said, "and they will slaughter you. You are sheep, they are wolves. Your blood will soak the hillsides, your skin will make saddles, your flesh will feed pigs. They are the Ulfhirdnar, you hear me, Saxon? They are the Ulfhirdnar."
We had gone to Arnborg's hall, where a dozen of my men raked through the bedding and the wooden chests in search of plunder. I had taken nothing but food and ale from Halbjorn's steading, and even that I had paid for with hacksilver. But Eirika was determined to defy me, insult me and frighten me, so I allowed my men to ransack her goods. I let her rant for the moment, stooping instead to one of the hearthstones and picking up an oat cake. I took a bite. "Good," I said.
"May it choke you," Eirika snarled.
"Lord, look!"
Rorik, my servant, had dragged down the flag from above the gate. It was a pale grey banner on which was embroidered a black axe. He spread it wide, and I saw that it was a careful piece of work, lovingly sewn through the long winter evenings, a fine flag edged with a border of black linen.
"Shall I burn it, Lord?"
"No, keep it."
"Take one thing from me," Erika spat, and your death will be slow. Your screams will echo in the underworld. Your soul will go to the death worm and rise in timeless agony.
I took another bite from the oatcake. Your husband is Ulfhearn? I asked.
He is a wolf warrior Saxon. He feeds on Saxon livers.
And was thrown out of Ireland, I sneered.
Finan?
Lord? I smiled at Erika. Finan is from Ireland, I told her, then turned to him. Tell me, Finan, what do the Irish do to the Ulfhearn? He smiled too. We kill them, Lord, but only after we've blocked our ears with wool. And why do you do that? I asked, still looking at Erika.
Because their screams are like the crying of babies, Finan said.
And no one likes that sound.
So we dull our ears, Lord, Finan went on. And when the baby of Hjevnar are all dead, we enslave their women.
What do you think of this one? I asked, gesturing with the oatcake towards Erika. Too old for slavery?
She can cook, he said grudgingly.
Erika turned on him.
May you die like a rat, she began,
then stopped suddenly because I had rammed the rest of the oatcake onto her mouth. I held it there, crumbling it against her stubbornly closed lips. There is a slave market 2 days south of here, I told her, and if I hear one more word from you, I shall carry you there and sell you to some hungry Mercian, and it will not be your food he hungers for. So be quiet, woman. She stayed quiet. In truth, I rather admired her. She was a proud woman. Her eyes were full of defiance, and she had the courage to confront us, but I had seen that her words were scaring some of my men. Berg, I shouted.
Lord?
Berg was on one of the high sleeping platforms, searching through piles of fleeces.
You told me once your brother is an Ulfhearn.
Both my brothers, Lord.
Berg was a Norseman, one of the many who followed me. I had saved him from execution on a Welsh beach, and he had been loyal to me ever since.
I have been an Ulfhearn too, Lord,
Berg said proudly. He touched a finger to his cheek, where he had inked a wolf's head. That wolf mask was my symbol, painted on my men's shields, though the inked heads on Berg's cheeks looked more like a pair of half-decayed pigs. So, tell us, I said, what an Ulfhearn is.
A wolf warrior, Lord.
We're all wolf warriors, I said. We carry the wolf head on our shields.
A wolf warrior, Lord, is given the spirit of the wolf before battle.
He becomes a wolf.
Yes, Lord. A wolf warrior fights with the savagery of a wolf because he becomes a wolf in his spirit. He howls like a wolf, runs like a wolf, and kills like a wolf.
But we men kill wolves, I said. I could see my Saxons. The few in the hall were listening carefully.
We don't kill Fenrir, Lord, Berg said, and Fenrir is the wolf who will slaughter Odin in the final chaos of Ragnarok.
I saw Edric cross himself. So the wolf warrior, I asked, is given the spirit of a great wolf.
The greatest wolf, Lord, which means that an Ulfhearn fights with the anger of the gods in his heart.
So how do we, mere men, defeat the Ulfhearn? I asked, hoping that Berg would be clever enough to understand why I was asking him these questions. He was. He laughed and tossed a wolf pelt down from the platform.
We become Ulfhearnar ourselves, Lord, and you have already killed the Ulfhearnar in battle after battle. You are a wolf warrior, Lord, maybe the greatest of all the wolf warriors, and we are your pack.
I had killed Ulfhearnar. There were men who often howled like wolves, while other warriors called out insults. They liked to wear wolf skins. They fought like madmen, but madmen do not fight well. They have savagery and seem careless of danger, but the skill of war starts with the hours and days and weeks and months and years of practice. It is sword skill.